and welcome to another episode of the Criterion Quest, the continuing podcast series where we look at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we're joined by a special guest for this episode, our good friend Lee.
Hi!
As you probably guessed from the episode title, we are not doing the next spy number, Le Dame de something something.
Bois de Boulogne.
Yeah, whatever that film is called, I guess we'll find out soon enough. But we're doing a special episode this week in honour of the 50th anniversary 70mm roadshow of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, which is been kind of recently restored by Christopher Nolan and is going around the world screening in 70mm how it was meant to be seen.
I was going to say restored's probably the opposite word of what it is.
Yeah, it's an unrestoration is kind of what he's calling it. But yeah, we all got together and went and saw that, and so we figured we're going to do a special episode talking about Kubrick. Yeah.
Let's get into it. So I think this episode will revolve mainly around 2001, but yeah, let's talk about Kubrick at large.
Mm. Yeah, I figured like 2001's a safe bet, especially with this kind of touring 70mm thing around the world. Like,
we don't need to do a synopsis.
No, all of our listeners, we're sure you've seen 2001. If you have not, please go and watch it. Get your mind melted.
That's right.
Yeah. So I guess where do we want to start with this?
The dawn of man.
Well said. Yeah, it's like, I don't know, like, I think for all three of us, this was not our first time seeing it on the big screen either.
It was my third at the Astor, which was the only place I've ever seen it on the big screen.
Mm.
But I've grown up watching it. It's one of my first films I ever saw. Thanks, Dad.
Really?
Yeah, it was. My dad had about 5 or 6 VHSs, Monty Python, some other shit I can't remember, and 2001. And I was talking to Chris about it at the pub. It's like, before I had an understanding of what film is meant to be or how films are structured, I was exposed to 2001 at a ripe young age that I could just absorb it and love it.
At what, like not 5 at, or 6 or whatever?
Yeah, yeah, like, and have absolutely no understanding of what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's me as well, like, now.
two questions. I'm guessing you kind of enjoyed the whole first part with the Dawn of Man because you're like, yay, monkeys?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. I used to cack myself when they'd kick those pigs.
The pigs like tapirs or whatever, yeah.
They'd come and like nip their food and they smack him across the face. I'd like, as a little kid, like, bah!
Yeah. But then, like, in terms of later on when it gets to, you know, the monolith on the moon and then all the stuff with Hal, how did that...
So I think what I remember is not sitting through it, if you know what I mean. Like, my dad would put it on, I'd watch the monkeys, and then I'd go play with trains or my dolls or whatever, or, you know. And so it'd be on in the background, and I'd be watching it, but I wouldn't be sitting through it. So, yeah.
Secondfold, do you reckon... The second question, I should say. Do you think being exposed to such a, for lack of a better term, a non-traditional or non-linear storytelling has kind of helped make you interested in film?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And I love coming back to it and loving that I had that at such a young age.
Mm.
And I think it's made me more open-minded and susceptible to interesting concepts and new ways of making film and all that sort of thing. But getting into Kubrick, I've definitely got into Kubrick in my teens.
Yeah. I think most people do.
Yeah, I didn't know what Kubrick was. That was a film that we watched all the time. I didn't know who Kubrick was.
Yeah.
But then...
For boys... I don't know a single teenage boy that hadn't seen Clockwork Orange. You know, it's like all The Shining.
Well, I think our generation in particular, we were around that time for like the 25th anniversary or something like that for Clockwork, and being in Australia, it was still banned.
Yeah.
At the time, and then I think it was like 99, like when we were kind of, you know, 13 or whatever, like, you know, around that time, you know, early teenage years, was when it was having an anniversary and it went back into cinemas and then the ban was lifted. And so it was like, oh, this controversial film. And so that was kind of on our radar, I think, and we were the right age for that.
Yeah. I think those kinds of films, like, I mean, especially Clockwork for young boys, they kind of gravitate towards it. But for girls, what's the Kubrick film, like the equivalent of the Clockwork?
To be honest, I don't know how the girls would like Kubrick.
Yeah, that's true.
To be honest, I don't think there's another girl on this planet that I've ever had a discussion with.
Not really.
Kubrick. It's quite sad, really.
Cole, what's your opinion?
Cole,
Kubrick.
Cole fucking hates Kubrick.
I don't hate Kubrick. Kubrick is an amazing filmmaker. I just don't like the flavour.
Fair enough.
I don't like the taste.
Mm. Well, I was going to jump in and say one of my fondest memories is my best friend Boomba sitting me down and showing me A Clockwork Orange. She's like, you've got to watch this film. It is fucked. You won't believe the shit that goes down in this film. Oh, my God.
Boomba showed you Clockwork Orange.
Boomba showed me Clockwork Orange to, like, I can't believe this is a film. What the fuck? And I sat through it going, this is, like, one of the best things I've ever seen.
Sorry, you just blew my mind that Boomba showed you Clockwork Orange. Boomba shows you 101 Dalmatians. Boomba doesn't show you Clockwork Orange.
I know, right? It was like her dad put it on one afternoon, and it's just like...
It's a Sunday Arbor watch.
Hey, Uncle Greg, I get, but...
She's like, I was watching Dad watch his film, and I couldn't get over it. It was crazy. And I'm like, yeah, okay, right, I'll give it a watch. I'm like, that was awesome.
Yeah. We'll steer it back to kind of 2001. No, like, we're wondering how we're going to structure this in terms of, like, we figure it'll eventually devolve into just a Kubrick conversation in general, but we kind of got there initially. But I'm intrigued to see what you guys think, because obviously it's the 50th anniversary of this film. Still to this day, it remains one of the most important and respected films ever made. What do you think kind of... makes it endure so much? Is there anything in particular for you guys that stands out for that?
Probably the ambiguity of it. Every time I sit down and watch it, I'm like trying desperately to look for new clues to figure out what is going on.
Yeah.
Well, what it's kind of groping at. I mean, there's it presents you with a whole slew of themes, which are, I guess, loosely tied together, but bound ever so slightly enough to suggest that you can try and play with the whole film again and again and again and again.
Yeah. It's subtly presenting the idea of there is a complete and utter through line here for you to kind of grapple and try and understand, but whether or not that's the case is another story.
Because things like when it was made, the whole Blue Danube scene of, like, space opera and you know, spaceships and, like, I'm just trying to think what would have been before that. Would Star Trek have been before that?
Star Trek, the TV series, yes. This is 10 years before Star Wars.
But the moon landing had happened.
No, moon landing 69.
Oh, so this is before
pre-moon landing. This is 67.
You can imagine people sitting through this movie in awe. And it definitely doesn't hold up in terms of the time dedicated to long shots of spaceships. Like, we are so exposed to that now. Mm. And it does become quite drawn out and to the point of, it can be a bit lengthy in times. Not Blue Danube.
In places, like the Blue Danube song,
when
there's that lovely ballet of the twisting spaceships,
I love that.
Because it's a model and there's a high contrast in the lighting, you get to see these shadows casting... Like, I mean, the spaceship has a shadow casting over itself.
Mm.
And it looks better than most films these days.
Because it's real.
Because it's real, yeah.
It's not
so, I mean, I'm watching that sequence and enjoying it as I would, like, a ballet, I suppose.
Definitely.
What I think as well, like, those, for lack of a better term, like, the smaller, more prolonged scenes like that, that are, it's not necessarily progressing the story, it's just a ballet in space.
Punctuated by music.
Yeah, and that's the point. It's, I think, in terms of not only progressing the art form of cinema, like what you can do in terms of special effects, what you can do in terms of narrative, this is a groundbreaking film because Kubrick, his use of music here is one of, I think, the most impactful and important things. Like, people weren't necessarily using music like that in film to just, we're going to have an entire sequence playing out to an entire song, we're just going to let it go.
It's like a music video.
Yeah, that's it. And that's something you didn't normally see in cinema back then. There was obviously, you know, music being used, but it was more just filler or, like, you know, background stuff to, like, enhance the mood and things. This is just, no, I found this wonderful piece of music. I'm going to sculpt this entire sequence around that piece of music just let it be.
The apes smashing skeletons with the club to... What's the song that also Sprout Zarathustra?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, like, iconic.
Yeah.
Everybody that listens to that song pictures apes smashing shit with bones.
Yeah, it is synonymous with that, yeah. And I would go so far as to say Blue Danube, I think. Like, whenever I hear that song, I think of Spacious Twirling. The ballet, yeah.
And those stupid things where they're eating out of the straws and all that.
So gross.
Yeah. But on the point of how it stands up... the monkeys, they just look so silly. But in, like, their face, like, the way they eat, like, it's still really good for the time. But
oh, it's amazing. It's better than Planet of the Apes. The actual articulation of the, like, jaws and the mouths and everything.
It's amazing. But
it's just legs. It's because the legs are long. Like, they're human legs with hair on them.
And they made the mistake of putting real baby apes in there next to people in ape costumes. And you're like, let's see. Now, that's an actual...
But see,
I can suspend my disbelief.
It totally doesn't matter.
But I would go that any day of the week over CG apes. Yep. I just, whenever I look at CG, I just...
You like Planet of the Apes, the new ones.
I don't mind them. I don't accept
that
it is real.
That's human. That's like Andy Serkis doing his jam. And it's okay, but... Tom's kind of shrugging at that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's... I don't know, it's still, I don't know, like, I think you guys are similar to me, like, don't know how many times you've seen this film, but I think you brought up earlier, it's always challenging.
Yes.
You always notice something new, or you...
desperately try to figure out the clues and try to really concentrate this time.
Or I always seem to go in being like, yeah, no, I got this, I got that, like, yeah. I have... Yeah. No, because every time I watch it, I'm like, okay, this is what I think... This is my interpretation of what this film is doing and saying, and then every time I rewatch it, I go in with that mindset to be like, prove me wrong. Like, I kind of want him to. I want the film to challenge me and be like, no, idiot, you missed this glaring thing, and kind of, it keeps you on your toes.
See? Oh, yeah, you do go.
Well, I'd like to talk about the idea that you have for the first quarter of the film.
Mm-hmm.
The narrative is revolving around this mystery object, the obelisk.
Funny, interesting you call it an obelisk. I've always heard it referred to as the monolith.
Oh, the monolith.
Yes.
Yes.
What's obelisk?
No, well, that's... I'm actually referring to the monolith.
Yeah.
I may be getting confused with something else. The monolith, thank you. So the first quarter of the film revolves around this mystery object, the monolith. And then it goes into how, you know, the incredibly dangerous AI. Artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, certainly the first few times I watched it, the transition between that storyline and how is quite a intense shift in narrative. And you start to... I mean, there's a certain point in the film where you realise... What happened to the fucking monolith?
Mm.
So certainly, like, there's a mystery behind why are we watching a film about a monolith and then dropping that and then watching a completely different film, although it's also set in
space. Could you argue that the monolith is the main character?
I was going to bring this up later, but This time around watching...
Definitely the driving force.
This time around watching it, I actually thought that maybe that's the alien. Like, the...
Oh, yes!
Because, I mean, like... Okay, so we're going to get... Fuck it. We're just going to get right down into this film. Because this time around, I was watching it and I was thinking, like... All right, so that opening sequence is about this object that appears at the dawn of man. And they touch it. And there's this, it's kind of evoking a difference between the, like, an animal and some kind of sentience.
It's transmitting, for lack of a better term,
it is, though.
Yeah, and giving early Cro-Magnon man the ability to create tools. And then progress.
So it sets you off on the path to, say, sentience, right? Yeah. So you're going from, you know...
It's helping with the creation of man.
Yeah, that's right. So, and eventually, I mean, they obviously, like, they revisit the monolith at the end of the film, and you have modern man, or at least 19 or 2001 man, which is the past now, but yes.
Don't get confused with that.
Yeah.
So, they revisit the monolith, and then they get completely transmuted through some space and time. To experience what would probably be exactly what the apes that touched the monolith in the original, like the start of the film.
What did they gain there?
Well, that's right. I mean.
Well, my interpretation, like how I've kind of always viewed it, is the opening Dawn of Man stuff. It is early Cro-Magnon man coming in contact with this thing, the monolith, which then kind of imbues them with the knowledge to be able to create tools, and then therefore. And then we have one of the greatest ever jump cuts in cinema history, millions of years, like, you know, straight through, bang, to...
The bone
cuts the space.
Can you think of a better... do you call it, like, a match cut?
Yeah, match cut. The only other one I would throw out is Lawrence of Arabia, Lawrence blowing out the match, and then it's the desert sun.
Yeah, okay.
But it's then, like, that's such a profound statement as well, that jump cut. It's just like, yeah... Going from that to where we are now with technology, it's like, yeah, this is the blink of the eye in terms of the universe. It's such a wonderful statement.
Yeah.
But then it's then the encounter with the monolith on the moon, and it's the little subtle stuff with, like, it was seems to be purposely buried here, and then so it's like, okay, so it was meant to be found, I guess, by theoretically man, who it's...
It's like a kind of calling card.
Yeah, and it's that thing of like, okay, we gave you that first bit of intelligence, and you've now, as a society and a species, progressed to... You're now interstellar travel... interplanetary travel. You're now being able to... And you've gone to the moon, and you have technology and understanding, and you've found this again. And then that, towards the end of the HAL storyline... Or at the end of the HAL storyline, we get the information that it blasted out a transmission pointing to Jupiter. So it's sending man to Jupiter, where then again, Dave encounters the monolith, I guess, like, floating through space, and then goes through the Stargate, and gets a little complicated, and it's my interpretation is the monolith is then imparting the next phase of either evolution or understanding of technology, and it's moving from interdimensional and...
I reckon it's consciousness. I reckon it's a kind of... awareness of the universe.
Yeah.
Think of at the very beginning where the apes touch it and then they go into that kind of next phase of sentience.
Yep.
I always imagined that when you're going through that crazy light spectacle.
Yeah, the Stargate.
Yep. The Stargate, that this monolith is presenting you with, like, that next tier above what we are.
It's presenting you a new dimension.
It's the equivalent of a plant trying to understand what a human would go through. And then the monolith is presenting, here, human, this is a glimpse. I mean, like, there's even shots during the Stargate moments where it's like freeze frame on Dave's face and he's like kind of twisted and fucked up. You know, and it's like almost like he's on the brink of insanity there. And it's like his consciousness is approaching some other plane that's like you can't comprehend.
That's why I go to time as being the kind of new dimension forcing him to evolve and being able to perceive time as a standard concept that we as humans can't. And that's where you're left with the whole thing of when he's suddenly like seeing himself in multiple time at once, and it's kind of melding of
that. Yeah, I mean,
folding it in on top of each other and everything.
Yeah.
And then that's why he ends up like is back like fetus, like little star child thing. Yeah.
Wow, I went on a random journey that was so different to every other experience that I've ever had before. But the little snap video of Dr. Floyd. When he finally pulls out all the elements of how sings his, like, what's it called? Your final song before you die? What's that called? Like
Daisy.
Yeah.
No, but, like, it's not a siren song. It's
the swan song?
Swan song. Yeah, he sings his little swan song and then he dies and then it and pops up with the Dr. Floyd and Dr. Floyd says, something about you've arrived at Jupiter and we've had this monolith transmitting the signal to Jupiter and then there's the next monolith and all that sort of thing. I don't know, like, I've never interpreted it this way before, and probably the next time I watch it, I'll have a completely different interpretation. Yeah. But I kind of was like, they're sending them, and then, yeah, he goes through the Stargate. Now, would you say Stargate is a point of travel? Like, it's a...
I'm only referring to it as the Stargate because in prep for this today, I watched the Stanley Kubrick documentary of Life in Pictures, and that's what Stanley and Douglas Trumbull, the special effects guy who made that sequence, referred to it as.
Yeah.
So that's, like, yeah, I don't know. Like, that's just one coin. I always thought it was a black hole or something.
Yeah, or, like, a vortex. Yeah. I don't know what. Anyway, and then it's, like, all these colours and craziness. He's definitely travelling somewhere. You get the element of he's travelling because it's rushing past. And but then you start to see cliff sides.
Yes, and before that as well, you see... I always interpret it as, like, galaxies being born.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The creation of the universe.
Yeah, that's why I'm always...
of, like, matter.
That's why I always go back to the idea of he's being presented time.
Yeah.
And that's... And then it, like...
It's like the birth of the universe, and then you progress through the ages.
And then we're back at Dawn of Man, and, like, the creation of the oceans and land and all. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, see, I went somewhere way different.
It's such a long sequence, though. I mean, that sequence with the light show, the Stargate...
It's about 20 minutes or so.
Yeah,
the Stargate leading up to, like, those really, like, the jewel and tricolour landscapes, it goes for a long time. And you can, I mean, you're just really sitting there thinking about whatever you feel like.
You are literally just interpreting these images and your brain starts to wander and you're trying to connect.
Well, what I was going to say, sorry, was you've read the book.
Long time ago, like 20 years ago.
Does the book explain exactly what is going on?
No.
I can't remember.
Yeah, because is there a definite answer to this, or did he purposely do it to make you interpret it
The monolith is like an unknown. It's supposed to be like something that's...
It's intelligence. Like, they refer to it as we've discovered...
The first sign of intelligent life. So meaning it was... It's not saying the monolith itself, but it was constructed by...
And it's a transmitter, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
It transmits knowledge to the apes, and then it transmits a signal to Jupiter. Like,
so they know it was being made by something other than man. They don't know whether or not it itself is a being.
It's not I don't interpret it as a life.
No.
I interpret it as a transmitter. Anyway...
At the very... Like, on that note, one of the very last shots is Dave dying as an old man,
and then
reaching out to the monolith in the bedroom. And that's the only reason why I would think, well, why not? Why couldn't that thing be a fucking life form?
Or like, could he be reaching out to it because of his interpretation of it? It presented and gave him this gift of being able to, you know, this is my interpretation, the perception of time and everything and that. Kind of next evolutionary step, so he's reaching out towards it as if it is a god or something that has given him this gift, I guess. It kind of recreated him, and so that's why he's kind of...
Because I was thinking maybe it transmitted him and it took him to their world.
Mm.
Like I was saying, this is my interpretation after this view, and I've had several before. Mm. And so when you're seeing those cliff sides and all that sort of thing, he's arriving at their home or whatever... And then you see him in that weird ass room that's so not like
anything. The most Kubrick room ever.
Like, oh my god, am I watching The Shining right now?
Yeah, yeah. And
am I watching like every one of Kubrick's films condensed into a single bedroom?
Yeah, essentially.
But it's unlike any other man-made room in the rest of the film.
Yeah. So
the point of it kind of looks like a cell. To me, and it was like the couches and the artwork were very purposely put there. So if you imagine, say, you were taken by alien life forms, and then they were to keep you, and like not like a pet, but like
in like a menagerie.
Yeah, and what would that look like?
Star Trek reference.
Star Trek reference.
Yeah, I didn't get it. Nicole got it.
It's like a zoo. It's like a zoo for, like, you put the human in the zoo cell.
And then they observe him, and then, you know, he has memories of when he arrived, and then he has memories of him eating at the table, and then he's in his bed, and then he's reaching out, and then they've recreated him and returned him to Earth, because the last scene is him as an embryo, or an embryo, might not be him, in front of Earth.
Mm.
I don't know. I just went there. I don't know.
It's only like that's the glory of this film.
They've observed him for the remainder of his life, and then his plea is reaching out towards the monolith, and then they recreate him and bring him back to Earth.
Yeah,
and that's a nice way of looking at that. I like that.
But I think Kubrick as an artist, or is a lot of his films. It's there are the few that are very simple, linear, and that's the point. But in terms of actually what the film is doing and saying, he seems to, more often than not, leave it up to you, throw some ambiguity in there.
Yeah.
To help challenge you and make you kind of question what you're doing, what you're seeing, what's being presented. It's great.
I think more than that, this film, I mean, no one can ever speak for him now.
No, yeah. But and he wouldn't speak for himself. He just let his art be.
Good.
But I get the strong impression that he would make this kind of film and say, like, well, I don't really know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm putting some ideas together, and even I, when I finish the film, will think about it and maybe try and complete the project in my own mind.
Yeah, or like I watch and it. Then I'm sure like each time he would watch it, he would be like, oh, maybe I'm thinking this, maybe I'm thinking that.
Really, which is a remarkable experience because there's no other film I've watched, and every single time I've watched it, it's been a completely different experience.
I love it. It's
very
true,
yeah.
I don't know, like it's like really I remarkable. Said, my interpretation tonight is that the only time I've ever I always get to the vortex scene, and I'm just like, yep, I've got it, oh, and then I've no idea what's happened.
Oh, you're on the precipice of an idea, and then you back away because you're kind of scared.
Yeah, because you're like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah, it really fucks with you.
I reckon there's maybe one or two other films I can think of to throw in that category of every time you watch it, you kind of interpret it a different way, and I would throw out the Quatsy films, like Koyaanis Quatsy and Baraka.
Yes, yeah. Oh my because God.
But those are purely image That's films, images,
yeah.
And then however you're even feeling that day is how you interpret
evoking,
those.
Like Baraka is so like it's very evoking, and it feels like there is a purpose to the messages being presented. It's not random. There is
And there is a linear story there, but
it's left to interpretation. Much like this. Yeah,
you can be feeling a certain way on a certain day and interpret it totally different, but
anyway, it's so much fun. I love listening to others' interpretations, and I love trying to come up with my own. It's so much fun. But I was going to bring up, I wondered if it was before or after the moon landing because of the way Earth looked in space.
Yeah.
Did you notice how Earth looked all weird? I couldn't tell if it was the moon at one point.
Yeah.
I don't know if they had photos of what Earth looked like from space before the landing.
But it's obviously, you know, this 60s, so it's not...
It's not...
The highest of qualities and things. Like, they're still good quality.
No, I know what you mean, but, like, even quality-wise, like, it's just, like, did these people know what Earth looked like from space? Like, because it didn't even look like
I mean, if you're getting, like, really nitpicky, there are shots where, like, I mean, like, there's shots of Jupiter where you can see all of the Jupiter moons.
Like Titan and Ganymede.
And they're really close together, and they're really large, and it's, like, doesn't make much sense in the scales of planetoid and planet stuff.
No. But visually, it's beautiful.
Visually, it's a visual...
Oh, and that's another thing, the alignment. It always, the monolith always seemed to appear with alignment of the sun, earth, moon, or when it's floating through space, it has that beautiful, like, it's in the middle of Jupiter and its moons, and there's, I can't remember how many below and how many above, but it's like...
Well, it's like a galactic time clock. I always thought it was like, it's like, all right, well, it's not operating on human time scales. It's obviously operating on a galactic time scale or something. And so what would the hands of a galactic time clock be? Well, it'd be planets and galaxies and stuff like that. So,
I got something. It's going back to a point like ages ago. You were talking about the idea of how the film, you know, we're following the monolith essentially for a quarter or a third of the film, and then it shifts to the HAL 9000 story.
Yeah.
Like, the link that I kind of draw between those two is the idea that, you know, the monolith is essentially helping mankind progress towards technology, and then we're being presented a story of what happens when mankind takes technology too far. And then it's kind of that turning on in on itself, and then technology turning on man.
It's interesting because something I picked up tonight was I always thought whenever they discover a monolith, they discovered something new in technology. And I thought, prior to tonight's viewing, that when they discovered the monolith on the moon, they then discovered AI.
Okay.
But that's not right.
No.
Because AI was... They make mention of it 1992.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and just debunked my whole theory.
And the Jupiter mission is 18 months post the moon incident. Yeah. So,
which would be 2001.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when was, like, the Black Genocide?
What? Before we saw the movie, I joked with Tom. I dared him to, like, bring up the idea that Kubrick, like, nailed the future because there's no black people. There's no one but white people in this film.
I feel like you should and, like, quickly tell women. People that you don't think that should be the future.
Oh, no, they know. They know we're making a horrible joke.
Yeah.
But it's like, that's, I think,
it's
one
like,
of
yeah,
the...
Black
women.
It's like
it's
the
kind
black
of
genocide of 1999.
It's kind of shitty. Like, there is multiculturalism in the sense of...
There's, like, a German or a Russian...
But that I think, is very much a... Because this film was made kind of in the Cold War and the height of the space race between Americans and Russians.
Yeah.
And this is now presenting a future where America and Russia are, like, working together in space as opposed to being at odds, like, you know, and in a competition. So it's multicultural in that sense. But it's just shades of white. It's a very European-looking film.
Did you look at when they had to select their language preference?
Yes, and it's all, like, Dutch, Italian.
French.
It's all Christian-related.
And that comes up a bit as well, like, you know, state your Christian name. Yeah. You're just like, oh, God, just say first name. But, yeah, that's,
no,
like...
It is, in that regard, very, very dated.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I thought I wasn't going to do that.
No, you just owned it. You could have passed it off to one of us.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
But you didn't.
Now I'm swearing.
But yeah. No, I think, like, it's pretty damn close to a perfect film. I think it coming out, like, seeing it in its time, you'd be like, that is a perfect piece of art. But now, you know, 50 years on, we can find this little nitpicky... things that, like, it doesn't take away, detract from it being a wonderful piece of art. I think it makes for fun, bullshit conversation.
It's very much to the point of, like, hardcore trying to figure out what everybody is.
I was just saying, when you were saying about the nitpicking and all that, I was just saying we very much enjoyed listening to our other patrons of the film walking out their discussions. Clearly people had never seen it before and had no idea what they were in for.
There was this one guy who was just so angry about the science and was hating on the film so bad. And which baffled me, because I think, Tom, you were saying, like, Arthur C. Clarke worked so hard to bring some, majority elements of truth to what he's presenting. Well, and Kubrick as well.
Most of his published work is scientific. It's not fictional.
Mm.
Like, his 2001 Space Odyssey, the book, is very accurate in terms of science.
Have you read it?
Yeah, but fucking ages ago. Mm. Like, ages ago. That was the first book I ever read of his. If anybody else wants a recommendation, by the way, for Arthur C. Clarke, I would recommend Childhood's End, which is my favourite one, or Rendezvous with Rama, which is my second favourite one.
How do you find his work to read? Like, if I was to read...
It's quite dry.
Because if I was to read 2001 and it was, like, the movie as it is in a book, I think I'd struggle. Like...
Yeah... It's quite dry.
It's so,
like,
visual. Like, how could you read that? I don't know.
No, his ideas are grand enough that you're actually focusing on the ideas and the grandeur of, like, of what he is trying to represent for a human populace in the future. That's the visual.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? Like his
work
reading
can be visual.
Amazing.
Writing can be visual, yeah.
So, yeah. I guess, any final thoughts on...
Well, I don't know. We haven't really... We said we were going
to... Oh, no, I'm saying on 2001 before we move on to Kubrick in general. Have we cracked the nut that is 2001?
No one has and no one will.
I don't want to. And I was saying before, like, I do not want to ever read something that tells me what definitely is going on in 2001. I really enjoy... If I were to just know what it was, there'd be no mystery, there'd be no enjoyment anymore. I want to be able to, you know.
But I think any essay that's going to talk about 2001 is on the level of anybody else that's seen the film to some degree. You can have, like, a really amazing knowledge of film, but this is one of those kinds of films where you can interpret it any way you want.
And if you were reading that essay, that's just their interpretation.
That's their interpretation. Yeah. You can enjoy that's that and try, like, and discuss it. It's always going to be a discussion.
It's just like your opinion, man.
It is. It is exactly right. But I think that the film is grand enough to express that, it gives you a sense of scale, which is, like, so amazingly grand in its scope that you would... It's like, for moments, like these long drawn out moments when I'm watching the film and it's like kind of maybe dragging on a little bit, you start to think about...
the emptiness of space.
You start thinking about like how far man could go with like kind of the space travel thing. And it's going like, oh, like I legitimately had the thought while I was watching this film. I was like, I wonder if man would live on beyond the death of our sun, right?
Well, we have actually gone into stellar travel.
Go into another galaxy. And then I even had the thought where it's like, I wonder if we'd have... If it's even possible to live beyond this universe. When this universe dies, you go to another one.
Yeah.
Like, this is the kinds of thoughts you can have with this film. It's amazing experience.
I would imagine... Like, I can't speak for the writer, the author of the book, but I would imagine that's exactly what he was hoping his readers to go through. Like, just the... Yeah, the limitless wonderings.
Yeah, Arthur Clarke is as incredible as Kubrick.
Well, on that note, I'm intrigued to see your guys' opinion. Clearly, all three of us absolutely love this movie. Would you say that this is Kubrick's best film? Not necessarily your personal favourite.
No. This 100% is my personal favourite. But I know that some of his other films are just—they're snappy.
You would consider that to be better made than this, because this is nowhere near my favorite Kubrick film. But I, like, for me, I think this is his best made film. Like, this is the best he ever made a film.
I feel like the opposite. Okay. This is my personal favorite, probably because I did that. I did have a connection to it from a young age, and I do really value that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think it formed me as a film aficionado.
Aficionado.
You said
aficionado. It's a new word. I'm taking that word.
I fucking love that. Yes.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
English language.
We're running that through the criterion quest. Fucking oath.
Yeah.
Yeah. From now on, if Tom and I like a movie, we're going to say we really appreciated this film.
I hope so. Yeah. Fuck, now I can't even make my point because I just said...
Go back. Here we go. Yeah.
So 2001's your like...
It's
your
my personal favourite. Do I think it's the best made? No. I think that Clockwork Orange and The Shining and, like, there's much snappier made films of his that are... Yeah, I don't know. So that meant, like, the opposite of you.
Yeah.
I actually think that this is his... this is not my favourite Kubrick film, but I think it's his best film.
Yeah, you're in the same boat as me.
How do I gauge that? I gauge that on... I think that this film presents, like, a vision that is the most artistic that he's ever accomplished. It gives you, like, a window into something... incredibly large that I can keep coming back to again and again and again, and for that reason I think that that it's his best piece of art. But it's not my favourite. Favourite is Barry Lyndon.
I was going to say how to get into the next few films should be what's your favourite Kubrick.
So
Barry Lyndon.
I love Barry Lyndon to death.
Yes.
I rewatched that for this podcast
Well, it's... I've always had the impression that Barry Lyndon is not only your favourite Kubrick film, but it's one of your favourite...
It's probably one of my favourite films, yeah.
Yeah.
Why? That's a big question.
I think that it doesn't follow the typical three-act structure. It's kind of... It's almost meandering, but subtly so. Like, there's everything about it is subtle, but very direct at the same time. So... You will have, if anyone hasn't seen Barry Lyndon, they should go and watch it. It's like kind of an underappreciated Kubrick film, which upsets me slightly.
Yeah.
A lot, actually.
But that being said, I did bring, we were talking about this earlier today, and I said, like, I personally feel it's coming back into prominence in regards to it, you know, being, it's surprisingly high on the IMDb top 250. Criterion has just put it out as a two-disc Blu-ray.
Bless you, girl.
Sorry, thank you.
So I feel it is kind of... It's got that kind of cult following, I guess, but it's not that wide stream appeal, I guess.
Mm. It's the last Kubrick film I saw, in terms of I saw all the other ones first, and it's the last one I saw, I'm horrified. But I was talking about how when you love a director... to the point of you just know everything about their mechanics and how they work, and then you get to watch a Kubrick film for the first time. I was old enough that when I first watched Barry Lyndon, I was just like, oh, I love this is awesome. I laughed it up. It was so good.
No style. Yeah, I mean, like it's a incredible piece of, like, I mean, shit, there is no artificial lighting in the whole film. Everything is on a tripod except for two scenes, and it's expertly chosen those two scenes to take the camera off, and it's almost like, I feel like Barry Lyndon is the film that Tarantino wants to make.
Okay, now, that's
because it, every single, nearly every single scene in that film is, you start at a level and you build up the drama and tension until it reaches a crescendo and then falls away to the next.
Yeah.
And Tarantino does this all the time.
Yeah.
He's always, like, Inglourious Basterds is the perfect example. But
Pulp Fiction.
But Pulp Fiction. Like, there's so many films that he's trying to, like, understand. How do you start a scene, build tension, get people really riled up and thrilled, and then just drop it away for the next one? But Barry Lyndon does it, in spades, but... so delicately. Like, there's an older podcast who were talking about a duel sequence.
Mm.
I don't remember the film.
It was Colonel Blimp. Life and Death of Colonel Blimp.
There's a duel sequence in that, and I think in that episode I brought up how amazing a 1v1 duel could be.
Yes.
And I brought up Barry Lyndon.
Which is, the duel scene in Barry Lyndon is next.
It's next level. It's next level. Like, that is, that like,
just the simple line of, you will have to stand your ground.
Yeah.
So
like, it's a really long.
That's what you're talking about, the subtlety. Yeah. I can understand.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Tarantino is trying to get that scene.
Yeah.
In as many films as he can, but he just can't do it.
He doesn't,
as well
as Kubrick. He doesn't have the patience that Kubrick does. Kubrick is ratcheting up tension through stillness and calmness and just smooth as can be.
I don't know, like, yeah, I mean, I think Barry Lyndon should have its own podcast, but
we will eventually when we get to the 800s of Criterion.
Well, I was going to say, he's only just hopped on Criterion. They've only just got him on.
Well, no, I kind of misspoke when I told you that earlier, because he had Spartacus, which is like number 90, but that's him as a hired gun. Yes. That's like him having just done Paths of Glory with Kirk Douglas. Kirk Douglas, who produced Spartacus, having a big falling out with Anthony Mann, who was directing it, and bringing in Kubrick, who he just had a great time working with, it, to kind of take over. But, so there's Spartacus, and then kind of in the, about, I think, the 500s, we've got Paths of Glory, his fantastic anti-war film. Have you guys seen that one?
I haven't seen that one.
It's a film about, Kirk Douglas plays a German general, commander of troops. They're given orders to, you know, it's World War One, like, go over the barrier and, like, go into battle, like, out of the trenches, and his troops say no, because they will all be killed. It's like a suicide mission. And so they say no, and then it's about basically the idea of, like, well, then you'll be brought up on charges and killed because you didn't obey orders. And so it's this wonderful anti-war film. Like, it's what makes Kubrick great. Everything he fucking does is the best of that genre.
Totally. Just so he had that ability to go across multi-genres.
And it was his fourth film?
Yeah.
And also in the collection there's The Killers, which is about a racetrack robbery. It's a huge influence on Reservoir Dogs.
Hang on, is that a Kubrick film?
The Killing, yes.
I haven't seen that. I thought Barry Lyndon was my last film.
No, and I've then...
More?
Yeah, no, me too.
Brilliant.
And then more recently, Barry Lyndon and Doctor Strangelove and things have come into the collection. So, yeah, Doctor Strangelove, which is my favourite Kubrick film.
Doctor Strangelove.
Yes, I grew up on, like, the one Kubrick thing that I grew up on was The Shining. I got shown The Shining when I was, like, about 7 or 8 years old.
That's fucked.
My mom's
people's first Kubrick film.
That's great. No, yeah. It's great. But, like, yeah, just kids these days, I don't know.
I would not fucking show an 8-year-old The Shining. Like, that's nuts. But, it helped make me, so I'm okay with that. So I grew up on The Shining, and then when Clockwork came out, when I was, like, you know, 13 or whatever, like, got into that.
You showed me that.
Mm.
You got me into Kubrick, actually. Clockwork was the first film I ever saw of Kubrick's. You were like, Clockwork.
Oh, yeah.
And you were like, oh, my God.
You've
got to go see
this. This is satire at its greatest.
Yeah.
But,
we were very young at that stage.
Mm. But... To me, Dr. Strangelove hits and works on so many wonderful levels in terms of it being an anti-war film to some degree as well. Like, it's not an anti-war... It got kind of raked over the coals when it first came out. It was like, oh, remember, because it was at the peak of the, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis and all of this, you know, the nuclear hysteria. And so he did a film where it's basically like pointing out the absolute absurdity of
the
nuclear warfare. And he does it so perfectly that it's hysterical, frightening, weird. Like it hits on every fucking level.
Exactly.
Do you know what I love about it is the characters and the conversations, such a conversation film.
Yes.
As opposed to what we just saw tonight, which was highly visual, very little dialogue. We were actually talking about his choice of main characters and all that sort of thing. We were talking about Full Metal Jacket and how the main character is so... I don't know, what would you describe him as?
He's a vessel for the audience,
yeah.
I think. It's nothing against Matthew Modine's performance, but... Private Joker in Full Metal Jacket is just a dude.
He's like,
there's nothing
he's like
really
a blank
there.
Piece of paper.
Yeah, where interesting shit happens
around him.
Yes, yeah. And he's just a vessel for the audience to go on this journey.
But in Dr. Strangelove, there's like so many characters, it's so conversation-based. And
not just that, you have Peter Sellers delivering the greatest performance of his life playing three roles at once.
Yeah.
Like, and to me, my, like, everyone always jumps to the ridiculous character of Dr. Strangelove himself, like, the fucked up Nazi, or the German Nazi scientist in a wheelchair who's insane. Everyone's like, yeah, that guy's fantastic, how he can't control his limbs. But then, he's so wonderfully measured and perfect as the American president, who's the phone call when he has to make the call to Russia, saying that...
Now, we've had a bit of a... What did he say?
He just went a little funny. And he decided to take the bomb. But to me, where the film shines is Peter Sellers as Colonel Mandrake, the British soldier, on the base with General Ripper, who has gone insane, trying to talk him down. It's so... Their Ripper, like him and Sterling Hayden... bouncing off each other is some of the greatest comedy ever put on film, I think. That's why I like Dr. Strangelove.
Well, do you know, we went to a Kubrick exhibition, I think you and I went, and it was at ACMI in Fed Square, and
the Australian Centre of the Moving Image.
in case you're like not from Victoria.
Which most of our listeners are.
Anyway, it's an amazing venue for all things film. But I remember there were so many props and sets and things from Kubrick's films. One of my favourite was the button pressing thing from Clockwork Orange, where he gets the milk from the nip.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Well, they had the Star Child from 2001. The actual model was there as well. Yeah.
But and they had all the handwritten things from pages from The Shining.
Oh, all the typed out work and no play makes Jack a dull boy.
Just right. Handwritten. Not like photocopied, handwritten.
Oh, the hand typed, yeah.
Hand typed from typewriters. Not photocopied.
It was that thing of like, I regret to say, it's like, do not touch the exhibit. I flipped through those.
But I know it's like such a silly thing when such grand, amazing things are there for you to look at. And you're like, oh my God, this is crazy. But my favorite thing in the whole exhibition was the miniature room, the war room.
Yep.
And I mean, if, like, it was like, what's that, four inches high, maybe not.
Yeah, and then maybe about 12 wide.
12 wide, it was really wide. But as you, like, would walk, you would miss this thing. You walk past it, and as you walk past, you could see every little grain in the floorboards, and all the little chairs, and all the papers on the thing, on the tables spread out, and the screens, and, like, it was amazing. Mm. And I know that's, you know, him being a perfectionist, it must be perfect. For him to have that wide shot scan of the room, like, oh, this is so cool.
Well, his production designer that he chose to do Dr. Strangelove, Ken Adams, who actually went on to do Barry Lyndon for him as well, win an Academy Award, he was... And why that war room set is so iconic is Ken Adams was the production designer for all the original Bond films, like all the Sean Connery, like, so big... volcano lairs and like gadgets and weirds and spies and so that's kind of Kubrick's like, yeah, well, we want that kind of ridiculousness for what we're doing here. So yeah,
because he's such a grand man, like for what is mostly set in a single room, like
yeah, it's set on in a room in an army base, a war room below the White House, and on a plane.
Yeah.
Like, that's the setting of that film, and it's so wonderful.
I would love to know how people felt about it when it came out, because...
Mixed. It's sorry to jump in there, but...
No, that's exactly what I
want
to find out.
Before, like, doing this, I watch this podcast tonight. I rewatched the Life in Pictures documentary. If you've never seen that, it's fantastic. It just goes through Stanley's entire life, and then each film as it comes out. And the recurring theme seemed to be every one of his films would come out... And it would be controversial, and it would get mixed reviews, and the audience would be torn down the middle. You'd either love it or you'd hate it. There was no kind of unanimous consensus of this was a masterpiece. Like, when 2001...
Commercially,
it was, like, fine.
Okay.
Like,
he obviously kept...
Barry Lyndon underperformed, and that kind of bummed him out.
Yeah.
But he never went really over budget and things. Like, he had a great working relationship with Warner Brothers, where they were like, we think you are one of the greatest filmmakers ever, so we'll just let you do... We're just happy you're working with us. So they would let him do whatever he wanted, Final Cut and everything. So he didn't kind of rock the boat in terms of fighting the studios or anything. But every film he seemed to make, like, kind of starting really with Lolita, was when it was released, like, controversy.
Yeah.
Controversy, 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 and, you know, it seemed to be people who loved film would adore his films, and then a lot of the general public would be like, that's weird. famously, like, going back to 2001... They had the first screening was an exhibitor screening, so it was like all the like a bunch of cinema heads and studios from all, like, you know, all the studios there sitting and watching it at this giant premiere, and it went over like a lead balloon. And apparently, like, his wife is telling the story, Christiana Kubrick is telling the story, that they went back to the hotel room and Stanley was like despondent and just like, oh God, what have I done? Blah, blah, blah. Like, and the Warner Brothers, MGM were like kind of freaking out. Like, what the fuck is this? Like, what have we made? And then the reviews came out and it was like, this is an, like, an amazing piece of art and beautiful and blah, blah, blah. He's like, oh, okay, cool. They get it then.
So what happened was, everybody went and saw the film.
From a business standpoint, being, well, how do we make
it? Well, I suppose so, but I'm thinking more like everybody had the exact same experience that everybody else has.
What is this film?
I'm going to need to go home and process this for a while.
And then, so it's fine. Yeah. But then the review started to come in and he was like, oh, cool. And then, you know, he got nominated for 3 Academy Awards, won his only ever Academy Award for 2001 for visual effects.
That's his only award.
Ba-bow.
Kubrick only ever won one Academy Award and it was for best visual effects because he helped direct the effects. Like
the that's why the best Academy, director of all time.
That's why the Academy's full of shit, man.
Yeah. He got nominated, I think, over his career like 10 or 11 times. But
would you say it's because he was before his time?
No, I think it's because what we've kind of been saying
the whole time is full of shit.
Not just that, but also his films are challenging. The Academy never gives the award to challenging films. Like, the one I will always jump to, and it's a controversial thing, it's why they gave Best Picture, they gave all the awards to No Country for Old Men instead of There Will Be Blood. No Country for Old Men is a fantastic film, don't get me wrong.
But no.
But it is nowhere near as challenging as There Will Be Blood.
There Will Be Blood. What was I going to say? Sorry.
But it's, sorry.
It was something about protagonists being not typical protagonists, not being the hero. So what I'm trying to get at is in Barry Lyndon and, say, in Clockwork Orange.
The Shining as well.
The Shining.
Anti-hero? What?
Like, the anti-hero, but, like, my favourite thing ever is when I've been talking to friends that have seen A Clockwork Orange, for example, and they're like, I hate that movie. Like, how can you make a movie about someone who rapes and is so horrible? It's a horrible person. I'm like, do you know what? It's so weird because I agree, but I can't look away. I love this character, and I know he's a horrible person, but I'm just really joking.
That's the point of the film. The film is not... It's the same kind of ridiculousness of, like, when... a modern-day facsimile is Fight Club. People who say they like Fight Club because, like, fuck yeah, like, the masculinity and the ideas, is like, oh, you missed the point of that film completely.
Yeah.
Like, that film is a satire of that. And that's what Clockwork Orange is. It's a satire of all of that horror. It's basically a media satire, almost. The idea of, you know...
Conditioning
and this kid being kind of, you know, being made a poster child for violence and rape and blah, 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 and then this rehabilitation... It's a poke on the media and the idea of them perpetuating this cycle of violence and destruction.
And I feel like in...
And sorry, just like on that note, like to approach it from the standpoint of like, oh no, that film's disgusting because it's violent and that boy rapes and blah blah blah, and you're like, no,
watch the
film. The film is very much saying this guy's a piece of shit, but we're pointing that out and also pointing out like, you know, making fun of the society that builds and allows that and kind of perpetuates that.
I think people get confused because if it's a protagonist, and they're like the asshole, then it's just like, oh,
they're not able to dissect the satire on that level. Yeah.
It's like if they see it in a movie, it's automatically glorified.
Yeah,
they feel that.
Same with the video game.
Even worse with the fucking video games.
Yeah,
to my chagrin.
Yeah,
they feel that because it is the protagonist, then it's glorified. But it's saying whatever their actions are okay. But I love that you explore his way of thinking in a way, and so the music, I know you probably have to cut this out, sorry. The music that is chosen for like a rape scene,
Rossini man, oh dude, Rossini. Oh, I love Rossini. Rossini is like the most psychopathic music. I love it.
It's like, whenever, who would ever in their right mind be bold enough to shoot a rape scene. Sorry, it's a bit graphic, but a rape scene with that hilarious music back.
Yeah,
it's to evoke your like your feeling. How he's delighted. He's ecstatic. He's finding it's funny.
It's the ridiculousness and the like the comedy of what it's being presented.
The William Tell overture
played at like played three times
speed with like him and two ladies.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
Yeah.
Clockwork Orange absolutely ridiculous.
Is a great comedy. But I just kind of, before we wrap this up, I'm intrigued. I want to kind of go around once more to see if there's a Kubrick film that you guys think is underappreciated. Or kind of, if you were to pick one that isn't necessarily... Yeah, you're
already Barry Lyndon.
Actually going to say Barry Lyndon for the pure fact that it took me so long to find it, but how appreciative I was that I found it the age that I did.
I found it like way too late. It took me way too long being already a Kubrick fan for ages to go... It's time to watch Barry Lyndon.
Yeah. It was an absolute delight, though. I'm glad I left it so long. I could see that if I watched this without understanding Kubrick, I would have found it difficult to watch. But because I understood Kubrick and his filmmaking, I'm like, oh, I'm loving this.
Barry Lyndon's like the Kubrick treasure that's kind of like sparkling underneath this lovely rough that you can just kind of like pluck out and go like, fuck yeah.
For me, I would argue Eyes Wide Shut is that for me.
Yeah, for sure. No,
I adore Eyes Wide Shut, and I think that's a film that is largely forgotten because he hadn't made a film in 12 years or whatever, and it was, you know, he died 6 days after handing in his final, his cart, like, so it had all this mystique around it, and people went and saw him and were just like, oh, yeah.
Did he have a final
cut? Yeah, he
And then six days later, he died after the final cut.
After he submitted his cut. Because of the working relationship he had with Warner Brothers, it was, they were like, yeah, no, Stanley's cut is the cut. Like, there is no...
How lucky he was to have that.
But because of being such a wonderful artist and working for a studio that recognised that, he worked for that.
That was a beautiful time and place, though. Like, I don't think that Stanley Kubrick could have done what he did
today. There are a few other filmmakers that have similar. I would argue Tarantino, the Coen brothers, Scorsese, Spielberg. Like, there are those directors. David Fincher as well. Like, there are ones
they're
who...
They're all old school.
Yeah. There's no one coming up.
Where's the new directors? Where?
Well, because you've got to work to be able to, and like, you know, prove yourself to be able to.
But it's, I mean,
because like, Kubrick didn't get Final Cut until post Spartacus. Like, Spartacus was the one where they were like, okay, you can now. You've done your due. You've earned your dues. You can do this now. So.
This is a whole nother discussion, but I think that. I mean, all of I agree with what you've said. I agree with all the names you've pulled out of the hat. That's producers say, like, it's fine.
Yeah,
do what you want.
We trust you.
But they're all old names. I don't know of a single new.
There's
name.
No one under 50 there.
Yeah, there's no one under 50.
Yeah, there's no woman there as
they're
well.
They're all old Hollywood.
Yeah,
you know, like, it's kind of something to think about there, which is different.
People aren't trusting of new guys.
Yeah, I know. Look at the Hobbit films. Look at the whole Han Solo's fucking.
Fire someone 90% through a film.
Yeah, Solo, a Star Wars story, whatever the fuck.
Safe to say, we need more Kubricks and less modern.
Ron Howard.
Oh, see, I don't mind Ron Howard as a filmmaker.
Well, I'm sorry, but he
made Splash.
Fucking Yes Man, man.
Yeah. I was like, did he direct that movie, Yes Man? No. Be ironic if he did. I guess that probably wrap us up for our kind of little bonus episode, Kubrick extravaganza. Unless you guys had any other final thoughts, I guess.
Well, no. we could go on for hours.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing we could just... So I think the takeaway from this is 2001 is a goddamn masterpiece. Kubrick's one of the greatest filmmakers ever. Go rewatch Barry Lyndon. And little asterisk, go watch Eyes Wide Shut. But I guess other than that, we would kind of love to hear if you have an interpretation of 2001 that is different than what we've thrown out. Please let us know by sending us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter at Criterion Quest, or on Facebook by The Criterion Quest. Other than that, we'll be back in a fortnight's time with Tom. Tom sees the title on the screen in front of him. What is it?
The Dames.
La Dame du Bois d'Abalion.
That one!
I think.
Heavy asterisk. I know it's directed by Robert Bresson. I know that much.
It's from 1945, and I can be certain of that.
Yeah. Otherwise, other little bit of housekeeping. For new listeners who are looking for back episodes and can't find them either on iTunes or your podcast app, they are available on the website of thetalkingpictures.com. You can find them there. They're all available for streaming and downloading there. Just our RSS feed only allows 100 episodes at a time, so that's kind of where they are. And why not as well, if you feel like it, have a listen to my other podcast, You Haven't Seen That? Where we sit and watch films that our good friend Eric never saw. I think Tom's coming up.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I'm doing some shameless plugs here. Yeah. Mainly because I'm getting you hyped for your episode that we're recording in a week or two when Eric gets back from Finland.
What are we doing?
We're doing Dumb and Dumber.
We're doing Dumb and Dumber.
If you're looking for a change of pace instead of Tom and I reviewing... you know, Le Dame de Blah Blah Blah. I want to hear us review Dumb and Dumber. Give that podcast a listen.
Yeah, we're going to pick it down a level.
Yeah.
And I adore Jim Carrey.
Yes.
So, let's get silly.
Yep. That's enough shameless plugs. Thank you for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed our Kubrick discussion. For this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom.
I'm Lee.
See you next time.